Hello, folks. We come to you tonight from the 12th Pier Production Studio, where James Boyes will discuss the first year of Donald Trump's presidency, its historical parallels, and possible futures. I'm Michael L. Roberts. This is the American Chronicle. Welcome to the American Chronicle, and we're launching straight in this evening in the first year of the first Trump administration. I've noticed a substantive shift in the questions people ask me about Donald Trump, a shift from matters of tabloid and social media sensationalism to matters of real concern and consequence for US domestic and foreign policy. I'd like us tonight, then, to bring proper historical context to bear on each of our questions. So, James, for those who express concern at a two-term Trump presidency, impeachment would only bring about a President Pence, as you've noted previously. The Democrats look unwilling to front a serious presidential challenger at this juncture, or indeed any time soon. Historically, then, what other means could prevent a second term for President Trump?
So one of the interesting things, which far too few people give any consideration to, is the fact that historically, in the modern era, it is revealed that an incumbent president who wants a second term in office will get one unless they are forced into a primary by their own party for the right to run as their party's candidate for president for that term in office. If we look back through the modern era, going back to when Harry Truman becomes president, for example, we see that those incumbents who have managed to avoid a serious primary challenge get a second term, and those that are primaried lose. Therefore, it can be deducted, I think, that the greatest challenge to a second term for Donald Trump actually comes from within the Republican Party, not from the Democratic Party.
So where could we look for that potentially to happen now with Donald Trump?
I think one of the most interesting developments has been the decision by Senator Flake not to seek re-election in Arizona. That means that he will not run in the 2018 election.
Let's take a moment now then to listen to Senator Flake delivering that decision on the Senate floor.
Mr. President, I rise today to address a matter that has been very much on my mind. At a moment when it seems that our democracy is more defined by our discord and our dysfunction than by our own values and principles. Let me begin by noting a somewhat obvious point that these offices that we hold are not ours indefinitely. We're not here simply to mark time. Sustained incumbency is certainly not the point of seeking office, and there are times when we must risk our careers in favor of our principles. Now is such a time. It must also be said that I rise today with no small measure of regret. Regret because of the state of our disunion. Regret because of the disrepair and destructiveness of our politics. Regret because of the indecency of our discourse. Regret because of the coarseness of our leadership. Regret for the compromise of our moral authority. And by our, I mean all of our, complicity in this alarming and dangerous state of affairs. It is time for our complicity and our accommodation of the unacceptable to end.
Senator Flake there. James, your thoughts on this resignation moment?
By not running in 2018, that would give him, between now and moving forward, a great deal of time to consider his options, to canvass the land, and to potentially put together a presidential exploration committee that would be well positioned and well financed, I think, to challenge Donald Trump moving into 2020. That, I think, is the most dangerous proposition for Donald Trump. Not that he could be defeated by an unnamed, unknowable Democrat at this point, because frankly, there are very, very few individuals in that party who I think have a cat and hell's chance of beating Trump outright in a straightforward up and down fight, but that he could be undermined from within his own party by members of the Republican Party who believe that Donald Trump is essentially a cancer upon their party and their brand, and who want to save the party, but in the process will undeniably merely split the votes and undermine the Republican Party, lining up a unexpected win for the Democrats in 2020.
So a Heseltine-esque stalking horse for Trump, potentially.
Yeah, I think the parallel between Thatcher and Heseltine is fair. The idea that you've got a seemingly undefeatable leader who is suddenly now got a dagger in the heart, effectively lying out there, just waiting in the weeds to potentially come back and to really undermine Donald Trump, possibly. This is obviously, you know, a hypothetical situation at this point. But if you were to listen to Senator Flake's speech on the floor of the United States Senate when he announced his decision not to run again, this is clearly someone who is motivated by, I think, love of party and ideological commitment to conservative causes, and sees in Donald Trump someone who is a detriment to the party, someone who is a cancer upon the Republican Party, and someone who is can only be to the long-term detriment of the entire cause of the American right.
You gave the example earlier there of Truman. Which other presidents have been denied a second term via this stalking horse primary approach?
So if we think about, many people don't know, for example, that Harry Truman chose to run in 52. Harry Truman was the first president in office after the change in the law came in. The Republican-controlled Congress decided that after Harry Truman's predecessor, Franklin Roosevelt, had gone on to win four elections, that should not be allowed to occur in the future on the basis that what we don't want is an American Caesar. Truman was not bound by that because he had already been elected, and therefore the law wasn't applied retrospectively. So Truman could have carried on running as long as he'd wanted. He had, of course, become president after FDR had died in Warm Springs. He'd won a surprise election in his own right in 1948 and was expected in many cases to run again in 52. And he had initially put his name forward as a candidate in the New Hampshire primary, but had been defeated by Adlai Stevenson, who went on to become the nominee that year, and both in 52 and 56 got resoundingly beaten by Dwight D. Eisenhower. So Truman would be an example of a candidate, an incumbent who was denied re-election because of the primary process. Moving forward, you can look at the example of Lyndon Johnson, for example. Lyndon Johnson was someone who was primaried by Gene McCarthy very successfully, McCarthy winning 40% in the New Hampshire primary, leading to the decision by Robert Kennedy to get somewhat belatedly into the race, and then Lyndon Johnson deciding not to seek re-election live on national television March 68. Moving forward, we can see something similar happening to Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford was the incumbent moving into the 76 election, and he was challenged and primaried by Ronald Reagan. Again, undermining the ticket, Ford went on to win the nomination but lose to Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter himself, again, was the incumbent heading into the 1980 election. Although he again won the nomination, he was wounded mortally by the candidacy of Senator Edward Kennedy, who challenged him in the primary season. And again, moving forward to 1992, George H.W. Bush, whilst he again won the nomination for the Republican Party in 1992, it was only after a very bitter fight with Pat Buchanan. So what we see is these incumbents who, yes, they go on to, in some cases, secure the nomination, but they are mortally wounded below the waterline. And that mortal wound often only reveals itself in the last stages of the campaign, when they are roundly beaten by their opponent from the other political party.
Before tonight's show, we were discussing the argument that before FDR, these kind of decisions were made in smoky back rooms rather than through forced primaries. In the post-FDR age, how do sitting presidents ensure a second term when dealing with their party?
I think we can make an argument that actually comes much later even than that, as late as 1960, for example. When anybody discusses or addresses the campaign season of 1960, people talk about the primaries that that John F. Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey engage in across a variety of states, but those states are very, very small in number. And the fact that no one talks about Lyndon Johnson being in the primary, for example, is important, because back then the primaries were seen as, you know, a relatively poor route to the nomination. And the reason Lyndon Johnson didn't campaign in the primaries in 60 was because he believed that they were largely irrelevant, and that Humphrey and Kennedy would effectively cancel one another out, and Lyndon Johnson would step in at the last minute at the campaign convention and secure the nomination. What you have seen in subsequent years is incumbent presidents recognizing, I think, that what they need to do most to secure their nomination for re-election and then a second term is to pander effectively to either the right of their party for Republicans or to the left of their party for Democrats. You don't want to be out ideologued effectively within your own party. It's impossible to be seen to be too far to the right or too far to the left, depending upon which part of the spectrum we're talking about. So, you know, look at Bill Clinton, for example. You know, he was weakened in 1994 by the loss to the Republicans. When I met him in 1995, my quip to him was, "Good luck next year. You're going to need it to a certain extent." Because many people assumed in 1995 that Bill Clinton would be a one-term president, and he managed to outflank anybody who might have come along to challenge him, went on to get the nomination and then secure a second term against Bob Dole. So the extent to which a presidential candidate who's the incumbent and what they need to do to secure election is very much, I think, to be seen to be akin with and beloved within the party more than within the country.
Within the Republican Party, then, are there any young bloods you see at the moment that in the fullness of time might become contenders for party leader and indeed president?
Yeah, I think that within the Republican Party, I think one of the most interesting candidates is Adam Kitzinger, who at this point is an appallingly young member of Congress, it must be pointed out. There's an old saying about, you're getting old when the policemen start looking young. Well, that's certainly the case when members of Congress start looking young. Kitzinger's a 39-year-old member of Congress out of the 16th Congressional District in Illinois. He's a moderate Republican. He's someone who has a military record. He served in the United States Air Force, for example. He served overseas. He served in Special Operations Command. He's someone who has held elections since 2010, if I'm not mistaken. And he speaks with great authority on a whole variety of issues, and from a very moderate, temperate platform within the Republican Party. He's seen, to me at least, to be someone who represents the inherent values of the Republican Party, as was in a sort of a pre-Trump era, a fundamental belief in limited role of government, but, you know, there to act very much as a safety net. You could make an argument that he's a classic sort of Reagan Republican in many, many respects, and someone who I think would be a very appealing and attractive candidate if the route to power in a few years were to open up. For example, he could move from the House to a Senate seat in Illinois, which is not impossible, quite frankly, in the years ahead, and then a potential run for the presidency in a cycle or two's time. It's his time has not yet come, but I think it'd be interesting to see how he could well position himself in some 5 to 10 years. I think.
Speaking of age as factor, there, we've discussed in previous episodes in this series the fact that on the Democratic side, would-be presidential candidates are all now too old to run for the presidency. And indeed, Bernie Sanders, America's Jeremy Corbyn, as you've called him, isn't even a Democrat. What then do you think is the appeal to many young people of the views of Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn, Noam Chomsky et al.?
I tell you what I think it is. I think it's that these candidates speak in a candid fashion, in the full knowledge that they will never need to exercise the authority of leadership. They're also speaking to a generation of under 25s who have no living memory of what utter chaos the Democratic Party was in prior to 1992. You know, in the US, in the 1980s, the Democratic Party at the national level was simply unelectable. And you have a parallel here with the United Kingdom with the Labour Party of Michael Foot and Neil Kinnock. You know, there is a direct parallel between the status and the electoral catastrophe of the Democratic Party in the US and the Labour Party in this country. And what changes that? Well, what changes that is something which a generation of people in both countries have no living memory of, effectively, and that is the shift towards the centre, which in the US is brought about by Bill Clinton. And that ideological approach is shoplifted, quite literally, by Tony Blair and the New Labour Project and transposed to the United Kingdom. It comes about after the end of the Cold War. The politics of the radical far left have been completely neutered. And so, you know, mainstream left parties, the Democrat and the Labour Party, recognise that they need to move rightward towards the centre to achieve electoral success. Bill Clinton does that adroitly in the US in the 92 election. Tony Blair and his team fly to Little Rock, effectively get hold of the Clinton electoral playbook, return to London, cross out the word Democrat and replace it with Labour. So New Democrat becomes New Labour. And what you're seeing with both Corbyn in the United Kingdom and with Sanders in the US is, you know, a pandering back to the good old days prior to 92, when the left of centre parties in the US and the UK were truly left of centre and represented, you know, left of centre perspectives and hadn't been hijacked, as they would see it, in an attempt to gain electoral authority. That's fine. You know, it depends what you're in politics for. If you're in politics to, you know, howl at the moon and make a point and to stand for something which might not be politically tenable, then that's great. Go for your life. But the result is electoral oblivion. And what Clinton and Blair did, whether people like it or not, is to make those parties, the Democratic Party and the Labour Party, acceptable to middle America and middle England for a political generation. Now, clearly that time has passed, and the leadership of both the Labour Party and the Democratic Party as such have moved on. But to where? We will have to see. Neither of them hold office at this point, it must be pointed out. And the only route to power for both parties at this point seems to be because of the collapse of support for the party of the right rather than any great groundswell of support for the party of the left, be it the Democrats or the Labour Party in the UK or the US.